Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 33 of the VCE Biology Podcast. This episode covers part of Unit 4, Area of Study 1, and I'll be talking about the structure of DNA and the genetic code it contains, as well as information on genes and genomics. So we all know that if one living thing reproduces and produces an offspring, the offspring will look awfully similar to its parents. And we now, of course, know that that is because genetic material is passed down from the parents to the offspring. And of course, we now know that that genetic material is in fact DNA or deoxyribonucleic acid. But we in fact know the structure of DNA now because of two really smart scientists by the name of Watson and Crick. We also know that DNA actually has genes. So these are small heritable units. You know, you inherit genes for eye color, or you inherit genes which, if you're a fly, give you particularly shaped wings and things like that. And we in fact know about genes through the work of several people, but really importantly, a guy called Gregor Mendel discovered these heritable units, and he did it by working with pea plants. So this chapter's, you know, about genetic material, and it's about the structure of DNA, which we learnt a bit from those guys Watson and Crick. And it's also about genes. And I suppose, you know, the stuff that we know about genes really stems back to that guy called Mendel, who really helped us increase our understanding. Now, deoxyribonucleic acid is actually a very big model, but it's actually built of many basic building blocks called nucleotides. And all the nucleotides are very similar in their structure. Every single nucleotide has got a sugar part. The sugar is called deoxyribose, and that's, you know, it's a carbon ring. Each nucleotide has also got a phosphate part to it, and the third part of each nucleotide is a nitrogen-containing base. So DNA is built up of many nucleotides. Each nucleotide has got a deoxyribose, a phosphate part, and a nitrogen-containing base. But while the sugar, you know, the deoxyribose and the phosphate parts are the same in every single nucleotide in a big stretch of DNA, there are four possible different nitrogen-containing bases. So these four different bases are called adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. So you've in fact got four different possible nucleotides. A nucleotide with adenine on it, or a nucleotide with thymine on it, or a nucleotide with cytosine, or a nucleotide with guanine on it. And in fact, we give those four different bases, so those four nucleotide bases, we distinguish them by the letters A, C, G, and T. So adenine A, cytosine C, thymine T, guanine G. Now, while a nucleotide containing a sugar, a phosphate, and a base is not a very big molecule, DNA can be a really big molecule because DNA normally has a chain of nucleotides joined together. So maybe thousands or even millions of nucleotides joined together in a really long chain. And for that chain to form, a bond forms between the sugar of one nucleotide and the phosphate group of the next nucleotide, and so on and so forth. So there's this bond between the sugar and the phosphate all the way up the chain of nucleotides. And what happens is you'll then have one end of the DNA, which has got a phosphate group at the head, and this is called the 5' end. And at the other end of the long strand of single nucleotides, you'll have a sugar, an empty, you know, a leftover sugar molecule, not leftover, but a sugar molecule at the end. And this is known as the 3' end. And 5' end and 3' end actually have to do with the numbers of carbons in that sugar. So the carbons, you can count around the ring of sugar in deoxyribose. And when you count the carbon molecules, you'll end up going 1, 2, 3, and there'll be a 3' end, and that's where the sugar molecule is. But on the fourth and on the fifth carbon molecule of deoxyribose, that's where the phosphate group binds to. And so that's why when the phosphate group is at the end, we call that the 5' end of the DNA chain. So there can be a 5' end, which has a phosphate group on it, or a 3' end of DNA, which has a sugar molecule at the tail end of it. So that's a single chain of nucleotides, but a DNA molecule actually contains two long chains of nucleotide molecules joined together. and it forms what's called a double helix structure. So in fact, the sugar phosphate backbone of those two nucleotide strands is on the outside of the helix, and the nitrogen-containing bases are on the inside of the helix. So if you think of a bit like a ladder, the sugar phosphate backbone is the sides of the ladder, and the two bases joining in the middle are the rungs of the ladder. Now those two long chains of nucleotides actually run anti-parallel to each other, so they run the opposite direction. So at one end, you'll find one of the nucleotide chains, there's the 5' end, while the other of the nucleotide chains is the 3' end. Whereas at the other end of the molecule, there'll be the 3' end and the 5' end of those two chains. So, you know, they run in opposite directions. Now, getting back to those bases in the middle of the DNA molecule, in the middle of the double helix, each base can only form a bond or, you know, kind of join together with one of the other bases. So what happens is either an adenine-thymine pair forms and they're joined together by two hydrogen bonds, or a cytosine-guanine pair forms and they're joined together by three hydrogen bonds. So the base pairing is very restricted. So adenine can only join with thymine, A can only go with T, and cytosine can only go with guanine, so C can only go with G. So A with T and C with G. And these are called complementary base pairs, AT, CG. And because DNA contains complementary base pairs, if you know the DNA sequence of one of those strands of bases or, you know, nucleotides, then you'll be able to elucidate, you'll be able to figure out what the other chain is. So for example, if you know that there are four bases, A, C, G, and T, then you know that the other strand has got four bases, T, G, C, and A. So A, C, G, T must bond with T, G, C, A. You know, it's that A bonds with T and C bonds with G. So this is complementary base pairing, and that holds together the two rungs of the ladder. That holds together the DNA double helix in the middle, those two bases, the complementary base pairing. Interestingly, because it's only held together with hydrogen bonds, it's not a very strong bond. So in fact, if you heat up a DNA molecule, the two chains will separate from each other at about 90 degrees. So if you heat them up to 90 degrees, the two strands, the two big long chains of nucleotides will separate from each other. But when they cool down again, because those complementary bases want to be next to each other, the two chains will rehybridize or, you know, join back together with each other. So we talk about DNA being a very long molecule or a very big molecule. The length of a piece of double-stranded DNA is normally expressed as the number of base pairs that it contains. So you might have a bit of DNA which is 1,000 base pairs long or 1,000,000 base pairs long. If you've just got a single strand of DNA, the length is just expressed as the number of bases. So single strands don't have base pairs, only double-stranded DNA. So each human chromosome, talk about humans, contains one long molecule of double-stranded DNA with millions of base pairs. So we've got, 23 pairs of chromosomes, and each chromosome is one really long strand of double-stranded DNA and varies, but millions and millions of base pairs in each chromosome, whereas a gene would consist of tens of thousands of base pairs, and there are different length genes. But each human cell would have in it an estimated 20 to 25,000 genes encoded in its DNA. So human DNA has actually got about 3 billion base pairs in total. Of all those base pairs, there's only about 20 to 25,000 genes in the DNA. And as we know, most of the DNA in a human cell is located in the nucleus. So it's separated from the rest of the cell by the nuclear membrane. But lots of people don't know there's actually also some other DNA in a human cell which is outside of the nucleus. It's called mitochondrial DNA, and as the name suggests, it's found in the mitochondria. So human mitochondrial DNA is actually 16,568 base pairs long, and it codes for 37 really important genes which have been highly conserved throughout evolution. So those 37 genes basically There's 13 genes, and those genes code for proteins that are involved in cellular respiration. So cellular respiration, that's got to happen in cells, otherwise the cell dies, so really important genes. There's two genes which code for ribosomal RNA, or rRNA, and there's 22 genes that code for transfer RNAs, or tRNAs. So there's a little bit of DNA found in our mitochondria, and it's found on a circular chromosome. But obviously the rest of our DNA is found in the nucleus, and you know, there's in fact 3 billion in total base pairs of DNA in each human cell, and there's about 20 to 25,000 genes. So in a double-stranded DNA molecule, only one of the strands contains the information which codes for a gene. So this strand is called the template strand, or sense strand, and the complementary strand is often called the non-template strand. But we know so much about DNA these days that we can actually sequence the bases in a strand of DNA. And so you can either sequence the bases in the template strand of DNA or in the non-template strand. And so you can, DNA sequencing is basically figuring out the order of the bases. So you end up with this readout from a, it's called a DNA sequencer, a readout from a machine, and it's just the order of the bases, A, C, T, G, G, C, T, T, A, T, T, whatever it is. So you can, you know, we can sequence the bases in a DNA molecule. And in fact, in all organisms, genes and so genetic material is built on the same code or the same alphabet of these four letters, A, T, C, and G. And different genes vary in those sequence of letters. So different genes will have, one gene might have A, T, C, G, 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 T. The other would have T, T, C, C, G, G, T, T, G, T. You get the idea. So DNA is just an information-carrying molecule. And the information is coded for using the four bases, A, T, C, and G. So, you know, we can think of a book as something which carries information. And the information in a book is coded using the 26 letters of the alphabet. And it's, you know, it forms words and it can be decoded into, you know, a string of words. Well, similarly, DNA, the coded information, is just the string of A, T, C's, and G's. And when it's decoded, we in fact get, in a gene, the decoded message is an order of amino acids in proteins. So DNA codes for a message, and the message makes proteins. So by encoding these instructions on how to make a bunch of different proteins, the different genes in an organism control the structure and the biochemical and the physiological functioning of that organism. So different organisms will have different proteins because they'll have different genes. Now, while using the alphabet and writing words in a book, different words can have different numbers of letters. The genetic code is referred to as a triplet code. That's because three bases, and only three bases, code for one single amino acid. So a different three bases will code for the different amino acids. Each triplet is actually called a codon, and there are also start and stop codons. So in a gene, you'd have a start codon, and, you know, so three bases, and then the three bases in groups of three after that would each code for an amino acid in the protein, and then the gene would end with a stop codon. So when we talk about the 3 billion base pairs in human cells, or we talk about the 20 to 25,000 genes in human DNA, we're actually talking about the human genome. So the genome of an organism is its complete set of genetic instructions, and obviously it's encoded for in the DNA. And there are scientists who study genomes, and that field of study is called genomics. So, you know, humans have quite a large genome, 3 billion base pairs, but humans are all different. And in fact, many of the differences between one human and the next are found in things called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs. So this is where one single base is different between one person and the next, and that might change the way one particular protein works, and then that'll change something in their physiology, or, you know, the way they look, or the way something works. So, you know, single SNPs is what really often makes humans different from one another, because really 99.5 of, you know, my DNA is exactly the same as yours. Our genomes are very, very similar. Now, if we collect information about the genomes of two different species, we have the capacity to then compare those two species' genomes with each other. And this is called comparative genomics. So you can compare the DNA of one species to another. You know, for example, the genome of a chimpanzee is very similar to the genome of a human. Now, when we compare genes from different organisms from different species, or even different organisms from the same species, we'll sometimes say that the DNA sequence is different. And this happens because sometimes DNA mutates. And this can happen when cells are undergoing mitosis or meiosis. You know, the DNA replication process can make a mistake, so you know, you'll just get a mutation. Or sometimes mutations can be induced by mutagenic agents such as X-rays or UV radiation or nuclear radiation or some special chemicals. So often you'll get what's called a single base mutation, and if this mutation occurs in a cell that's undergoing meiosis to create a sperm cell or an egg cell, then that mutation will be passed on to future generations. Obviously, if the mutation occurs just in regular mitosis in, you know, in someone's, I don't know, muscle cells or skin cells or something, the mutation won't be passed on to future generations, but there'll be, you know, some slightly mutated cell. So you can have these single base pair base mutations, and there are a bunch of different types of these mutations. You can have a substitution. So this is where one base, you know, maybe T, is replaced with another, for example, C. And this can, in fact, you know, if it's in a gene, this can result in nothing happening. So it can result in one codon still encoding for the same amino acid, but it can change the amino acid that the codon encodes for. So if a single base pair mutation occurs in a codon, it can be silent, and so that codon can still encode for the same amino acid. Or it can alter the amino acid that codon encodes for, and thus it will slightly change the protein that that gene encodes for. Other single base pair mutations are either additions, so an extra base is inserted in the DNA when it's been copied, or a deletion, and this is when a base is deleted in the DNA when it's been copied or something. So additions or deletions are known as frame shift mutations. And this is because every codon, every three bases after that addition or deletion, will be changed slightly. So it will either, it will shift the number of the three bases, either forward one or down one. So it will change this sequence of amino acids that get produced from that gene in every single codon from the addition or deletion onwards. There are also some gene mutations which involve the addition or deletion of a larger number of bases. For example, you can get di, which is 2, tri, which is 3, or tetranucleotide repeats in stretches of DNA. So you could have a dinucleotide repeat might be AT, 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 and a mutation might be you get an extra copy of an AT, or you know, one or two less copies of the AT. So these di, tri, or tetranucleotide repeats can vary in number between individuals too. So you can see there's lots of different mutations which occur in DNA. And that's, in fact, why evolution happens, because DNA is slightly changing over time. So lastly, in terms of the structure of a gene is more than just a start codon and then a bunch of codons which carry instructions for amino acids and then a stop codon. There's a bit more to it than that. So for a start, genes have actually got flanking regions on either side of them. The region before the start of the coding region is called the upstream region, sometimes called the promoter region, and the upstream region of a gene, one part of that's rich in adenines and thymines, A's and T's, and that's sometimes called the Tata box, so that helps kind of, you know, get the gene to start being transcribed and translated. And then the downstream region is obviously the flanking region, which is at the end of the coding region of the gene. And in fact, in terms of the actual gene itself, a gene is made up of exons and introns. Now, the exons are part of the DNA sequence which actually code for a protein. But the exons are separated by these other parts which do not code for a protein called introns. And in fact, before a gene is really translated into a protein, the introns are spliced out, so they're taken away.
So the exons are actually the part of the DNA which really just codes for the protein. But there's all these other parts. There's these introns and there's flanking regions, upstream regions and downstream regions. And all these other things affect the way the gene actually works. So, you know, how many copies of each protein it actually produces. So, yeah, there's a coding region of the gene. And that's when you get down to it, that's really just the exons. But there are also introns which are spliced out. And there's flanking regions which go on either side of each gene as well. So that's really the structure of a gene. And that brings episode 33 of the VCE Biology Podcast to a close. I'm Mr. Barlow, and thanks for listening.